Okay. The Transportation Committee will come to order. We've got several bills on the agenda this evening. We're going to push right through them as quickly as possible. Staff has been here every night this week until after 10 o'clock, and hopefully tonight will be a little bit different. We've got Senator Vickerman up first, but just so folks know, Senate File 2450, Senator Sieben's bill in relation to Newport, has been taken off the agenda and will not be heard. We also have tomorrow we will be marking up the omnibus transportation bill, and there's also three or four other bills that will be on the agenda, one of which is Senator Jungbauer's bill that has went through a couple hoops and over a few, I don't know what you call them, barricades here the past few days. So tomorrow will be interesting also. With that, we're going to take Senator Vickerman, Senate File 2462.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 2462 is an agreement. They bought and rehabilitated a rail line, and then things didn't work out, so they turned around and are unable to pay the loan off. So now they want to convert the loan to grants. And, Mr. Chair, in essence of time, I have three experts here that can explain this more to you than I can, and I will start on this side. I'm sorry to say that the auditor had to run back to Rock County. He had to leave early, and he is the secretary, but the chairman of the Rock County Board is here, and we'll start with that, and then we'll work down. And I want to also introduce you to Brent when you get there. I want him to say a few words.
Okay. Commissioner, will you state your name for the record, please?
Okay, Ron Boyangin.
Please.
Okay, Rock County Commissioner. Yes, you have the bill before you, I believe. And the Short Line Railroad we're discussing is owned by the Buffalo Ridge Rail Authority, an entity of Rock and Knowles County. I've been on their board since the beginning, I guess. About 1989 it started, was bought, and then rehabbed. Hence the two loans. The shippers are part of the organization. They put in some money. Both counties put in some money. What happened? The farming changed. At that time, they hauled grain, corn mostly. And in the 1990s, many farmers went to semis. And so we didn't haul much grain after that, and our volume went way down, contrary to some of our projections. Hence, our revenue went way down. We haven't been able then to make payments on the loan to the state or to the shippers and the counties. The counties and the shippers have written off their portion of the loans. Mm-hmm. And so we're asking for this loan. We were told at the time if things didn't work out, the state would consider making this loan a grant by MnDOT Railroad Section. And yes, that's
Mr. Chair. I think it's important to remember that there's a big ethanol plant in Laverne, and they have to haul ethanol. Cheapest way to haul it is by rail, not by car or by semi. So we're trying to get a loan forgiveness so we can keep going on. And I'm going to move to the next gentleman, and then I'll go to the real train operator on the left side. Say your name.
Mr. Chair, I'm Kyle Oldry, Rock County Administrator. As Senator Vickerman stated, we do have a letter from Agri Energy, and we do haul 90% of the ethanol that is produced by Agri Energy. It's the ethanol plant in Laverne by rail. The rail line does still provide a service, and it's a vital service. The where we're running into a problem is as we try to recruit new business, and they're made aware of the debt load that the rail line carries, there's a concern that at some point the loan will be called and what will become of the rail line. So we're asking to have the loan converted to grant to show that it is a viable line, that it will continue to be a viable line for not only the protection of the ethanol plant, but also other businesses that may be interested in expansion on the line in the future. Brent Polinchek is the operator through Minnesota's Southern Railways, and I think he can give you much more detail on the operation of the line itself.
Thank you. Is it Hollingcheck?
Polinchek.
Okay.
I don't want to pull off your things, though. Mr. Chair, excuse me. My name is Brent Polinchek, and I am the owner of Minnesota Southern Railway, and we operate the rail line that's owned by the Rail Authority. We've been operating this line since the middle of November of 2000, so a little over 7 years. It's been kind of a labor of love, I guess. We've worked real hard over the 7 years to improve the line and build our customer base. We've been successful in recruiting a couple of new customers in the local area. We've really concentrated our efforts on improving the condition of the line so that we can better serve our customers. We have reinvested 100% of our railroad revenues that we have collected. 100% of that has gone back into the line. My wife and I, Kathy, who run the line, have not taken a salary or anything for 7.5 years. The railroad, you know, we prefer to spend our money on the track instead of getting paid. So we eat railroad ties on the weekends and that kind of stuff. We've worked really, really hard. Would like to continue to do so. As Mr. Oldry mentioned, the ethanol plant depends on us to move their product. Currently, everything coming out of there we're sending to Texas. It's not an economical truck move to go to Texas. One of our other local customers that we started in 2003, we shipped their product to Idaho, California, Texas, and a lot of it into Mexico. And because of the fact that we're able to provide rail service to them is the only way that they could reach these markets. And because of their ability to reach these markets, they've been able to expand, add jobs. We have spent approximately 50% of our yearly income has gone right back into the track. The rest of it has been spent on, you know, wages, fuel, railroad ties, that kind of stuff. Working on a few other little projects, but again, as Mr. Oldry mentioned, the massive debt hanging over the Rail Authority's head is a real stumbling block for us. It prevents us from basically being able to move forward. What else should I say? Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess maybe my questions would be directed to you on just a series of questions, like how many engines do you operate, and does this line tie in with a major line, and then are the cars owned by you, or are they another railroad owns the cars and you're just transferring the cars around?
Well, to answer your first question, sir, we own two locomotives. They belong to my wife and I. The cars that we use and move, our ethanol cars, for example, are owned by one of the major tank car companies and leased by our ethanol broker. Our liquid feed customer, we assisted them in leasing their own cars. When we first started, we leased cars for folks, and then they didn't use them, and so now we let them lease their own. And as far as connections, that's one of the nice things that we're able to offer our customer is that on the east end of our line, we hook up with the Union Pacific. On the west end of our line, we hook up with the BNSF. So depending on the commodity and its destination, we're kind of able to pit the two big boys against each other. Whichever one gives us the most favorable rate, that's the one we use.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably to the owner of the witness. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name. You have, I don't know the size of your business, I guess, but if you're operating at a pretty reasonable amount of capacity, and I'm not sure that for a railroad, if $2.8 million, that you say it's a large amount of debt, do you have a lot of other debt besides this, or if you're operating at capacity, why? What happened so you couldn't service the debt?
Okay, that's you.
From the Rail Authority standpoint, the debt that was incurred was through the acquisition and the rehab. The partners in that were the state, the two counties, and the shippers. Three of the four, the shippers, the two counties, have each written off the debt. So this is the last remaining debt on the rail line. At that point, there wouldn't be any additional debt on there. Now, what Mr. Polinchek has talked about is trying to do additional improvements, and we may pursue additional funding, not through the state, but through federal means with rail lines to try to make improvements to the line.
And so, Mr. Chair, this is the only debt that the rail line is carrying. Is it operating at about the capacity that you expected it when you took out the loans?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no. The projections back in 1989, 1990, 91 were that we would move 3,000 cars a year. And we have yet to hit 1,000 cars. That doesn't mean that the service isn't important. We still provide it to the ethanol plant. But the projections when the rehab loan was given and when the acquisition loan was given was that we would be transporting 3,000 cars. And of those 3,000, the vast majority were going to be agriculture products from the elevators. The shippers were elevators down in our area. So that's why they bought in as well. Well, as the market changed and hog confinements came in and cattle feedlots came in and then ultimately the ethanol plant, the grain that was shipped out of Rock County has now all stayed in Rock County. And so the ag commodity other than ethanol is not being shipped, and that's why the projections that led to the loans initially have never materialized. Did that answer your question, Senator?
Thank you. Very good. Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair. What percentage of the total loans that were given in the 80s is this 2.8? How much was the county forgiveness and the other loan forgiveness in the total?
The acquisitions were 25% shippers and counties, and the rehabs, I believe, were 10% shippers and counties. So the majority were state loans, Senator.
Thank you.
Further discussion. Is there somebody from DOT or maybe finance that wants to be in?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Gardner, Minnesota DOT Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. We certainly appreciate the good efforts of the operator and the Rail Authority in trying to make this line successful. However, we can't support the bill for the following reasons. The bill would really fundamentally change the nature of the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program from a revolving loan program to essentially a grants program. The bill would really establish a significant precedent for the other loan applicants that we have and recipients, and we fully expect others to come to the table asking for forgiveness. And we do have about $7 million in additional loans beyond this one, loans of this type, with rail authorities. We are proposing some changes to the program under the omnibus bill. We did a comprehensive review of the Rail Service Improvement Program about a year ago. We talked to a lot of stakeholders, and almost without exception, they prefer a loan program versus a grant program because it results in better projects. So really, all those reasons combined, we really can't support the request. I think having said that, however, what's important is the preservation of the corridor. So if the service is not viable, determined to be not viable at some point, and goes into abandonment, It's important to consider this corridor for the state rail bank for future transportation uses or alternative uses such as trails.
Well, Mr. Gardner, it sounds like if the ethanol plant is going to continue to succeed down in that neck of the woods, that they're going to need this rail service to make that happen. So I don't see us turning that into a bike path anytime too soon. Unless you want to, Senator Olson. No? Okay.
Whatever you say.
All right. Well, you gave me the look, so.
Yeah.
I expect it from Senator Jungbauer on bicycles. Anyway, committee, I think that we're at a point here, and Mr. Gardner brings up a good point about, you know, we might as well just make this a grant program, and we all know how well grant programs work from time to time. But I'm unwilling to let Senator Vickerman leave here with only his hat in his hand. Members, so I would entertain Senator Jungbauer's motion to recommend that Senate File 2462 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Between now and then, Senator Vickerman, you need to work this out so that the department has a little more comfort, all right?
Mr. Chair, I'm more than willing to do that, but I want to be sure the department will work with me.
Oh, they most certainly will. Sometimes we don't like the answers that the department gives, but they're willing to work. And
that's all I'm asking.
Yep. All right. Further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, Senator Jungbauer renews his motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator
Thank
Vickerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members
folks,
of the
folks, thank you. Senator Erickson Ropes, Senate File 3412.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for hearing our bill this afternoon. I appreciate it. We've had some testifiers that have been hanging in there with us today since 12:30, and some of them had to leave, but we're bringing you a great bill this afternoon, and I just want to tell you a couple quick things about it. But first, this is my first committee stop, so I'd like to make an oral amendment, just a couple little things that will help sync it up to the House version. The House version is sailing right on through over there, so they've made a couple changes. Is it a good time right now, Mr. Chair?
Sure thing.
Okay. If you look to line 2.9, delete the words as certified, and then on the next line, by the manufacturer, and insert on a paved level surface. I'll get to the explanations in a minute. And then on the second page, the first sentence says greater and then in between and otherwise. Do you find?
Can you give us the line number? 2.1?
No, it would be after, it would probably be 211.11. I don't okay. have, I have a copy of pulled off the
internet.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, 2.11.
So it's the first line where it's talking about wheel diameters of 10 inches or greater and, mm-hmm. and then insert, except with respect to maximum speed. Thank you. And those two changes will sync up the language between our Senate version and the House version.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why don't you tell us what this does and why it's a good idea?
Okay. Well, it's a great idea. Uh-huh. And I don't know to what extent this committee talks about the three green wins, but I know you are concerned about some of the carbon emissions. But this bill...
Senator Ropes, I'm sorry. Senator Scoy, you wanted to adopt those oral amendments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to move those oral amendments
okay.
first.
All right. On those amendments, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Thank you. My bill follows Senator Coring's bill. He carried this bill a couple years ago, which made street legal small electric vehicles on highways up to 35 miles an hour. And essentially, they'll be called neighborhood electric vehicles. And therefore, driving around town from your house down to the grocery store to the bank, that sort of thing. They're right now, by law, allowed to go 25 miles an hour. My bill will increase the speed from 25 miles an hour to 35 miles an hour and make that a new category from the low-speed vehicles that Senator Coring's bill was to medium-speed vehicles, being those that go up to 35 miles an hour, still on the same roads and the same rules. I have a member here from the industry to answer any technical questions you have about the cars themselves. But basically, my bill follows legislation. We dug up legislation from Montana. The state of Washington and Colorado have all done this ahead of us. And this is widespread through Canada and Europe as well. And again, I would just say for Minnesota, this gives us an opportunity to really win in three ways. It's a win for the environment because of the reduced carbon emissions. It's a win for the economy because we're really putting legs underneath a whole new industry that's springing up due to public demand for more electric vehicles. And it's also a win for energy independence as we move off of petrol-based fuels to these transitional cars that are great little hybrids to meet neighborhood needs. I'm going to circulate some brochures. I don't have a lot, but you'll see from these brochures, there's a collection of electric vehicles and all sorts of varieties just waiting in the wings to start and launch a whole new industry. Thank you. And there's also, I have another letter from that Representative Daphne passed out on the House side, attesting to the public demand for these kinds of vehicles. So many cities are also moving to e-fleets or electric fleets. In fact, I mentioned on the floor today that the Capitol has just purchased one of these vehicles. And they had, I didn't know if you got out there to see it, but there's a yellow electric truck that was parked outside the Capitol today, and they're using that for scooting around Capitol grounds. Excuse me. So as we discuss this bill, I would just ask you to think what you imagine the roads will look like in 10 years and what sort of vehicles are going to be out there on the roads. There are going to be lots of electrical vehicles. We're talking about many different kinds of diverse vehicles than we're used to seeing now, the great big cars. Fewer dependent on petroleum, fewer carbon engines, and that sort of thing. So this, again, is a small vehicle that would only be used in the neighborhoods for around town use, not out on the highways. And I'll stop there if you have any questions. And if you have any industry questions about vehicle safety, I have Tim Cummers here. Excuse me. So.
All I can say is I want one of these.
Yeah.
I might have to save up for a couple years. But Senator
Olson. Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Erickson Ropes, I guess I would ask this to your testifier. Are these vehicles exempt from, like, airbags and seatbelt requirements and those kinds of things?
My name is Tim Commers. I'm president of Cushman Motor Company. We're a small family business located in Minneapolis since 1949. To answer your question, Senator, they are not required to have airbags, but there is a safety requirement for the electric vehicles, and it's inclusive of seatbelts. and other safety equipment, but not airbags because of the limited speed.
Mr. Commers, and I'm sitting in for Chair Murphy right now.
Yes, sir.
The 25-mile-an-hour limit, that's a governor-imposed limit, isn't that correct? And you're increasing this to a 35-mile-an-hour governor-imposed limit.
That would be correct. If I could, just for a little background, these vehicles, we've actually been distributing this type of vehicle for about 2 years since the original legislation was signed. And two things have become very clear about these electric street-legal licensed vehicles in that time. And the one that we've learned through speaking with literally hundreds of people through doing energy fairs and green expos and trade shows and things of that nature is that a lot of people want to use these vehicles because they're 100% electric, zero emissions. There's a strong desire to use them. The other thing we've learned is that those same people feel that the 25-mile-per-hour speed limit on them prevents them from using them the way they were intended, which is to be commuter vehicles, running errands, short trips and things, because they have to share the road with other vehicles traveling 30, 35 miles per hour. They feel they're a hindrance to those vehicles and therefore preventing them from using the vehicle as it was intended. What they really want to be able to do is drive the vehicle at 35 miles per hour and 35 mile per hour posted speed.
Mr. Chair, I was just talking to Matt Simonovich, who's in the back here, and he's an owner of one of these vehicles, and he's been using it actually today. It's parked out in front of the Capitol, and he used it today to drive back and forth to university and run errands and drive around town, and he was just saying to me how he slows traffic down behind him. He's going 25 miles an hour, and he soon has sort of bumper to bumper behind him. And he's experienced people, passing inappropriately or having to pull over along the side of the road in order to let the traffic by. And if there isn't a place to pull over, people kind of get anxious behind him. So it really has become a safety issue as well. The car itself has the capacity to go up to 35 miles an hour. It has the safety features to support that kind of increase in speed, and all these vehicles would have to go to the dealer to get their, you used the term governor, Senator Carlson, it's called a governor or a controller, to get that adapted. It's a very complex software program that changes that speed. So people wouldn't just automatically, if this bill were passed, go out the next day and start driving 35 miles an hour. They have to go into the dealership and get it changed. And if their car does not comply with the safety standards of the medium speed vehicle definition, they wouldn't get their governor changed.
And I guess Senator Ropes and your guest, Mr. Commers, can you tell me the standards difference between going from a 25-mile-an-hour vehicle to a 35-mile-an-hour vehicle?
Yes, yes. As it's currently written in to this bill, it shares the same specification change as it did for the other states that have adopted it, and that is everything basically remains the same, with the exception of calls for either a roll cage or crush-proof body.
And Mr. Carmers, I do have a little problem with the term crush proof. Legal terms, that actually means something different than what I think you intend.
Yeah.
It should be crush resistant.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's the language that's in there, though.
And then when you go, you have a 35-mile-an-hour vehicle and you want to go to a road speed vehicle, an ungoverned vehicle, what are the additional standards you would have to meet then?
those are standards that the Department of Transportation places upon manufacturers of automobiles that I'm not an expert in that area, but essentially you're going to vehicles that have been crash tested at highway speeds and the addition of airbags, and I'm sure a host of other equipment.
I guess that's the standards I'm interested in, is what standards do you are you allowed to pass on when you're at a 35 mile an hour limit?
The standards of the that are laid out for the 25 mile an hour limit, I can tell you what those are. How that differs from a highway vehicle standard, I can't tell you what is required in a highway car. On the 25 mile an hour electric vehicles, they require shatterproof glass, automotive brake system, full lighting, windshield wipers, washers, and of course the seat belts, shoulder harnesses.
Mr. Chair, I think you're asking your question from the top down. We're starting with a pretty narrow scope of what this vehicle does. It's only street legal in neighborhoods, and it's not the same class as a car that you take out on a highway.
Senator Ropes, one problem, and you know we've had this conversation already, that it will be out on the highway. And in fact, I'm sure that probably the fifth buyer is the one that's going to remove the governing ability on it and is going to try to take it out on 494. And so they will be out on the highway, and they will be hit by other cars, and they will hit other cars, and they will hit everything that is on the road, the same as the automobiles that are out there today. And that's the concern I have with this automobile.
Mr. Chair, I'd say the same thing I said to you earlier today, and that is that if somebody's bound to break the law, they're going to break the law. You can bring a bicycle out on the highway right now and then probably potentially cause an accident. But if you're just biking along the side of I-90 or 494, you're going to get arrested. So if people have the wrong vehicle on the road, if somebody's driving a 35-mile-an-hour neighborhood vehicle out on an interstate, you know, they're going to get arrested. And could somebody do that? Sure, they could probably, you know, toot down the ramp and get on there. But, you know, anyone has the opportunity to break any law they want in the state of Minnesota, and there's consequences for that.
Can you answer another question on the governance? Take away the governor, what's the maximum speed the vehicle will do?
These vehicles, pretty much the maximum speed they're capable of is 35 miles an hour.
The governor is on the vehicle right now to keep it at 25.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add something, that in essence, you could take a vehicle out onto the freeway. You could do that now with the 25 mile an hour vehicle. I guess what I'm trying to say is, I guess you could break the law. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't, you know, I think you'd be drawing a lot of attention to yourself, of course, going whether you're going 25 or 35 on the freeway. I think we've all come up on people that are probably doing something that foolish in a car for one reason or another, usually talking on a phone. But it becomes pretty obvious that they're doing it. So I don't know that there's a way to prevent people from breaking the law, but they could, in effect, do it right now with their 25-mile-an-hour car if they so choose to.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to make another point that there's many states, especially in the southern states, that are going to these kind of vehicles and legislations faster than we are. In fact, a lot of cities are moving to e-fleets, electric fleets, to replace some of their public transportation vehicles. I believe that Mr. Hero, who I just talked to, who owns another business in Princeton, which is Senator Wergen's area, and she was one of the co-sponsors of Senator Coring's bill, He told me he'd just gotten a letter recently from the city of Tampa requesting a certain number of vehicles, four-passenger vehicles, that they're going to put in the downtown area of Tampa, you know, to shuttle people back and forth. So this seems to be the way many cities and states are interested in going, and I'd ask this committee to consider joining the troop. And, in fact, we could really find ourselves at the nexus of a whole new industry here. It could possibly bring manufacturing and jobs to the state. We certainly want to encourage commerce. And this is a whole new industry that's just ready to blossom. As the public, I'm sure every single one of you have heard of the public's interest in electric vehicles.
Mr. Chair?
No doubt. Senator Olson.
With this and then our PRT in transit, and we'd have the greenest place in the world.
Right.
And be wonderful. Right?
Yeah.
Senator Olson, you don't miss a trick, do you? With your PRT. So, okay, is there anybody else that wants to testify on this bill?
Cute, aren't they?
Senator Olson, did you have a
just at the
question?
Time I'd like to move it.
Okay, Senator Olson has moved that Senate File 3412 as amended be recommended to pass and
that's noisier. Yes,
re-referred to the Senate floor. Senator Ropes, would you also want this in our omnibus transportation bill?
Are you going to pass
backup.
It, Mr. Chair?
Pardon?
Are you going to pass your omnibus bill?
Well, we're going to let your bill go on its own as well. But just in case you get hung up someplace, you'll have a safety net.
That would be great. Thank you very much.
All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Erickson Ropes. Senator Latz, Senate File 2502. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Senate File 2502 is a bill that would basically require MnDOT to establish their funding priorities consistent with the funding priorities that are determined by the Transportation Advisory Board for the Metropolitan Region, part of the Metropolitan Council process. If a project goes through the Metropolitan Council's process and receives federal funding, and the Met Council and the transportation process through the STP process is the designated group that decides which projects get federal funding. If it goes through that, we believe that MnDOT should give that project a priority for funding as well. Sometimes we're not quite sure on what basis MnDOT makes its funding priority decisions, and this would be an important way to do it. The process that's in place is a very comprehensive process that has broad buy-in from a variety of stakeholders throughout the metropolitan area. Citizen members, members from the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, Transportation Technical Advisory Committee, the Transportation Advisory Board, the Met Council, quite a few different stakeholders, all of whom come together throughout the metro area to deliberate and consider how to prioritize proposals for federal funding and ultimately to decide which projects get federal funding. Our concern is that sometimes MnDOT takes its own route in deciding independent of this process. In the past, they used to follow this process quite closely, and there's a lot more collaboration between MnDOT and the Met Council process. That has not necessarily been the case in more recent years, and we think it is the better public and policy process to follow. The bill you have before you is, it's really the antithesis of earmarking. I know there are some that might be concerned that, you know, we're trying to earmark projects in certain areas or districts or stuff like that, but it's really the opposite. MnDOT's process is much harder to discern and much less collective in its input and decision-making process than the one done through the STP process. So what we really have here is the opposite of earmarking. It's the collective buy-in rather than cherry-picking projects. Former Senator and Met Council Chair Ted Mondale wanted to be here tonight to testify. He was originally on the witness list. Because of a time conflict, he was unable to join us. But he understands from both levels of government the importance of this process, particularly in his former role as chair of the Metropolitan Council when Governor Ventura was governor. And he encourages your support for this bill as well. Now, I have with me Marshall Hunold, who's here on behalf of the City of St. Louis Park, who follows the transportation issues for the city that I represent, and also Vic Moore, who's a policy consultant who's been assisting us in this matter as well. I'd like to ask you to hear their testimony.
All right.
Thank you, Chair and Senators. I'm here speaking on behalf of our city manager and our city council tonight.
Can we get you to state your name for the record, please?
Sure. I'm Marcia Honnold, and I'm the management assistant for the City of St. Louis Park. I thank you for your consideration and support of this bill. We believe that the Metropolitan Council's process as set out through the Transportation Advisory Board is a fair, competitive process for every community in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Their 2007 regional solicitation process, in which approximately $159 million of federal funding was distributed to communities, there were 133 applicants, including MnDOT, that competed competitively for those projects in a variety of categories. 44 were selected. And what we're asking for your assistance with is that projects that are selected, they're competitive, they're consistent with regional development plans, they're good for the regional area comp plans, that those projects are considered for funding so that they can move forward, so that communities that have received that will not have to lose their federal funding if it's not completed in the time allotted by the federal government. And I'll stand for questions.
All right. Senator Lantz, I understand the, your push for this bill and appreciate you bringing it before us. The one thing that gives me just a little bit of pause is that we don't have an off-ramp built into this in case there was some sort of emergency, another bridge collapse or something like that. And once MnDOT puts their projects out there, the money is kind of locked down. And if something aberrant happens in the system, they need to have a little bit of flexibility. And so what I'm saying is if we state in law that you have to follow the STP, the STIP, just by the letter, that could get them into a little bit of trouble. I do believe that they need to follow that as closely as possible. All across the state it works. I mean, you've got the involvement, as you said, from all the local road authorities. You have citizen input, and the process works well. If this bill was to move forward, we would want probably a couple sentences in there stating that the commissioner could deviate in certain circumstances, and then maybe by saying that they're going to do that and filing a letter of explanation to the authority in that district and also to the ranking members of this committee and the appropriate House committee as well. So if you can just kind of play around with that a little bit. I know that that our Department of Transportation probably has a little bit of heartburn, and I'm sure we're going to hear from Ms. Parker or somebody. But I think you've got a good bill. I think that if we work on it here a little bit, we could probably make it so that it's going to be very functional.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with your concern on that, and I'm certainly happy to try to work out language that would provide for an emergency-type exception process.
Okay. Any questions for the testifier or Senator Latz? If not, let's if Ms. Parker or someone from MnDOT wants to. Is this Ms. Bursaw?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Bursaw. I'm with MnDOT with our Metro District and our Office of Program Management. And our office is responsible for developing the funding program for construction projects in the metro area. And and we do develop that program consistent with both our state plan goals and priorities, as well as with the Metropolitan Council regional plan. We're, our program is consistent with that plan as well. And first of all, I would start out by saying I completely agree with Senator Latz in the very comprehensive and fair and equitable process of the Met Council and its Transportation Advisory Board in how it selects projects for federal funds. With the broadest interpretation of the proposed bill as we see it, though, it seems as though it would require MnDOT to prioritize or fund projects that have received federal STP funds through that TAB process. And this would be projects, I assume, on the trunk highway system. And these projects, as we've mentioned, are selected on a competitive basis, and it is considered to be a fair and equitable basis. But MnDOT would not support this bill for both financial and procedural reasons. Let me just quickly outline those. On the financial side, requiring this bill, in our estimation, would cause redirection of state trunk highway funds, because you need state funds to match federal funds, obviously. So that's what we're talking about. It would redirect those funds from needed bridge and pavement preservation projects and safety projects and redirect them to locally initiated projects. And this program we're talking about, the STP program, primarily these are what we consider expansion projects. And just as an example, in 2010, the from what we can see, the impact to that, if MnDOT needed to fully fund those projects to reach the total project amount beyond the federal dollars identified through the TAB process, that the impact to us would be about $18 million just in 2010 to provide additional funds to these locally initiated projects. The process has just been completed for another solicitation round for projects in 2011 and 12. And with the trunk highway projects that have been selected through that process, that would be another $12.5 million that would have to come from MnDOT. And again, all the state trunk highway projects, as Senator Murphy has mentioned, are already committed. They're already programmed through 2012, again, mostly for preservation and safety projects. So, in fact, some of those funds have already been identified for other locally initiated projects through what we call our Cooperative Agreements Program and Safety Capacity Program. But if we could just talk about the process through the Transportation Advisory Board real quickly. The TAB solicits for and selects projects for federal funds in the Twin Cities area for just certain program categories, federal program categories. MnDOT selects for some other categories. The ones that MnDOT selects for are interstate maintenance, national highway system, and some bridge funds. And much of those bridge, those funds and MnDOT's funds are, I think, relied upon through this other process to be taking care of basic preservation needs. Conversely, the projects selected through the TAB process are very specifically focused toward certain types of projects. The STP program itself is identified and focused towards mostly expansion projects, and counties and cities are eligible to submit projects, as MnDOT is as well, but primarily it is funding for counties and cities for projects. Some of those projects are on the trunk highway system. But through this process, it is a well-founded process, and MnDOT has, in fact, collaborated with the council for many years, and I think we have a very good collaboration on that process. Part of the qualifying criteria for that process are that the submitting agency must commit to responsibility for the local match of the federal funds that it receives up to the total project cost. Then they also must be able to provide a demonstration that if their proposed project is on within the jurisdiction of another agency, that that agency notes that it is aware of that and commits to maintaining that facility. I think if this measure were enacted, I think many local agencies would submit projects on the trunk highway system through this TAB process. And if, in fact, MnDOT was going to be required to come up with the funding for those, the additional funding for those projects, it would be likely that MnDOT wouldn't be able to support those projects then under this process if all of the funds needed to go to those projects to fully fund the projects.
And Ms. Bershaw,
yes.
That's basically a fiscal issue, though. That's not. That's just not having enough money to take care of everything.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's true. We don't have enough money to take care of everything.
We could have passed three of those bills that we passed earlier, and we wouldn't have enough money.
Right. I mean, I understand that. Yeah. And these are all, I'm certainly not minimizing the projects submitted and selected through this process. They're excellent projects. They're very good for the transportation system. But MnDOT can't redirect funds to fully fund those other locally initiated projects and especially redirect our preservation and safety funds. And I'll just note that if these federal funds that are selected through the TAB process are not for some reason able to be used on a project that is selected through that process, they're not lost to the state of Minnesota, they're not lost to the Twin Cities area. In fact, they are then redirected back to that process. So in closing, we certainly understand the importance of transportation improvements to state, regional, and local units of government, and also understand how significantly inflation has affected the cost of construction for MnDOT for local agencies as well. We clearly understand that, but MnDOT is responsible to continue with our highest priority of preservation and safety, and so we feel strongly that it's important that we do that, and mandating the redirection of those state funds would cause the delay or cancellation of those projects. So I thank you for the opportunity to provide those comments.
Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Bersaw, this kind of brings up, I guess, a problem that's been in our state for a number of years, and it's because we have a congressman that has a position in Washington that's been able to bring us millions and millions of dollars that will not necessarily fall into a MnDOT plan. And so I understand that leaves you guys with not being in your plan for probably a worthwhile project, but also there's an opportunity that money, federal money, is there for a number of projects throughout, not just the 8th Congressional District either. And so I've been a little disappointed that MnDOT as an organization hasn't been able to recognize that, you know, we are probably the only, at least right now, we're the only state in the nation that has the chair of the Transportation Committee, and he's bringing home some money for our state, and yet we can't seem to line up with that. And I know that's more than a metro problem, but I certainly know that it is a metro problem too. So I guess I'd like to see a little more flexibility within MnDOT to adapt to those dollars when they do come.
Ms. Bersaw.
Mr. Chair and Senator, so now you're talking about federal earmark projects, which are different than the formula funds that we've been talking about that come through a competitive process. And in some ways, there are similarities, certainly, when oftentimes we may receive just a portion of funds to perhaps get a project started, maybe buy some right-of-way, and then we're faced with coming up with the rest of the cost for that project. And if it is, in fact, a project that's not been identified in a plan or in a program, of course, to fund that project will require not funding something else. So I agree it is a challenge, and they're all needed projects or people would not be asking for them. But we are trying to realign as best we can plans and needs and funding.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. Bersaw, I kind of understand the issue, but I guess my question is, isn't MnDOT fully involved with the Mets Council and in the TAB and developing the STIP. I mean, it sounded a little bit from your testimony that MnDOT's got its list, got its list, and the Met Council and the TAB and the STIP that results is a wholly different list, and those are locally initiated projects that aren't consistent with the list for the metropolitan area that MnDOT comes up with, and I guess that's where I have a little bit of disconnect, and I think what we're trying to solve is a problem where stuff just completely out of the ordinary occurs from time to time. So help me reconcile the first question. You know, I thought MnDOT was fully collaborative and actually looked to the Met Council to develop the plan for the roads in the metropolitan area.
Mr. Rosal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble. Well, let me try to explain. What I was trying to lay out before was the difference between the competitive process that exists at the Metropolitan Council through its Transportation Advisory Board and the programming process that MnDOT undertakes in developing its projects. For you're right that they all end up in the same transportation improvement program. That's our four-year improvement program. But the projects that come through the TAB process, they do come in a different way. Those projects must be consistent with the Metropolitan Council's transportation policy plan, and as do MnDOT's projects must be consistent as well. But through the TAB process, counties and cities, as well as MnDOT, can submit projects that meet certain criteria, and they're very specific criteria, in addition to, of course, meeting the policy plan requirements. There are other kinds of criteria that that identify transportation problems, such as congestion problems, safety problems, and look at how well a proposed solution will or proposed project will solve that problem. And it's very competitive. The projects are ranked. A local unit of government that proposes a project submits a project and comes up with the best cost estimate at that time. Typically, they're 4 or 5 years out from when the project will actually be delivered, but presumably there's a fairly good cost estimate at that time. The federal funds are capped through the TAB process, however. Previously, they were capped at $5.5 million. This most recent solicitation, they are capped at $7 million. Many projects cost much more than that. The proposing agency is required to come up with a 20% match, but many, many times the match is much greater than that because the project cost is well in excess of that figure. So what happens then through that process is as the local agency or the proposing agency submits the project, as I said, part of that process is set up in which the submitting agency commits to providing or to being responsible for providing the local match. So presumably a local agency has a plan for how that total project is going to be financed. They wouldn't just submit the proposal and think they'll perhaps get the $7 million of federal SDP funds and someone is going to come up with the rest of the money. They need to commit to that and have a plan from the start. So that's how I was trying to explain that part of the process. And we do work with agencies. It's not as though it's a total surprise when an agency submits a project. But when they do submit that project, we're very clear up front about whether we have funds available to match those funds. And we have a couple of different avenues that we can explore to try to help with those projects, and oftentimes we do. We have a safety capacity program that oftentimes there are components of a project that will meet our criteria, and we can apply funds to that. In fact, we have, I believe, $1 million for the Trunk Highway 7 Wooddale project that we have identified. It's in a later year, and we're trying to work out how to bring that forward into an earlier year, and we have an access management program. So we try to work with the local agency, and it makes the most sense for the citizens of the state if we can all work together and try to deliver that project. But sometimes the costs are very great, and if we don't have the funds, and it's not been on our priority list, our point is that because it comes in locally initiated, it means something else has to move out. Did that answer your question?
Well, it does. It tells me that we got kind of parallel, you know, parallel processes going on between MnDOT and the Met Council. So maybe there's more integration needed.
Well, MnDOT also has a different set of, you know, not only roadways that they have to be concerned with, but a different set of parameters as well. And, you know, I can understand what the department's heartburn is here, and that's why I suggested that if, you know, we could build some sort of off-ramp here and maybe some clarifying language that, you know, when the, you know, talking about when funds become available, language like that, that I think that this bill can work and still allow the department enough flexibility that they can work with the two plans and make them work. But Ms. Bursaw, you have to understand, and I think that well, you've been around long enough, but you know that some of the locals have been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, much like, you know, MnDOT itself with certain projects have been on the docket for 20 years with no money attached to them. And, you know, now that there's going to be a little more money in the coffers, I really feel that if you would work with, you know, if you would work with Senator Latz and Ms.
Honnold,
that you can build an off-ramp into this bill so that it fits the direction that MnDOT wants to go as well, and still keep an eye on what Senator Latz and those folks want to do with this. But, you know, we all have local projects in our communities that are not being funded today, and it really causes some heartburn on the locals' part as to why they can't get their project moved ahead. I mean, you know, we've got them in Red Wing and Frontenac and Lake City and all over in my district. And, you know, sometimes the locals, they get a little tired of having to wait, and then they end up on Senator Latt's doorstep or on mine, you know, bills get written like this. So if you could work with Senator Latz, this is going to be part of our omnibus policy bill. So we want to make sure that MnDOT is able to make this work for the, you know, the betterment of our community. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, members, my understanding of the process, I may be wrong on this, I'm not on your committee, so I don't see it every day, but my understanding of the process is that at least within the metropolitan region, all of the transportation projects, at least those that have federal funding connected to them, go through the Met Council's Transportation Advisory Board and STIP process. So unless there's some other layer of projects that MnDOT is thinking about or that works with that aren't part of this process, there should be complete harmony. In terms of priorities, the concern is that sometimes the priorities of the STIP process aren't respected by MnDOT. And I also understand, so the concern about redirecting funds, you know, because something has come through the STIP process that's not part of MnDOT's list, I think wouldn't apply at least to the federally funded programs. I do understand the concern about available funding. So I've got a suggestion in that regard, which would be on line 2.8 of the bill. After the word program, insert "and subject to available funding." So it would read, "as permitted by the Federal Surface Transportation Program and subject to available funding, comma, the commissioner shall prioritize for funding." That way, you know, you get as far down the list as you can. subject to the money that's available, but the set of priorities would be then consistent between the mm-hmm. Met Council process and MnDOT.
Right, for those federally funded projects. Right. Ms. Bursaw?
And Mr. Chair, just one final thing. We're talking about the STIP process as though there's a disconnect between MnDOT's priorities and the Met Mountain Council's priorities, and I really don't think that's the case. Selection of a project for funding by the Transportation Advisory Board does not denote that those are the highest priority projects of any projects in the region of any type. I don't believe that that's what they've said. I mean, the Transportation Advisory Board's highest priority is preservation of the system from a policy basis. So we certainly don't ever intend to in any way not follow the STIP process or the STIP priorities. So I just wanted to make that clear. The project that on Trunk Highway 7, for instance, you know, is clearly in the STIP for total project funding with the federal dollar amount, and we're in no way trying to minimize the priority of that project.
Mr. Chairman, obviously St. Louis Park has a project that's in there. So do hundreds of communities that are wondering when their projects are going to get funded and prioritized and are concerned about MnDOT unwinding some of the process. But if, in fact, there's no disjunction here, then there shouldn't be any objection.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, just one more time. Those projects that are in the STIP receiving STP funds, each of those communities has committed to the local match for those projects in receiving mm-hmm. those federal funds. That's why they're there. Mm-hmm. So if they have those funds, then there wouldn't be a need for MnDOT funds on those projects. But unfortunately, in all cases, that costs may have gone up or there may have not been an ability to put all of those funds together.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Bursaw, with the change that Senator Latz has suggested there on line 8 on page 2, is your discomfort starting to wane a tad bit?
Mr. Chair, well, it's waned somewhat. I'm still, it's not entirely clear what it means, I think, in terms of identifying for or prioritizing those projects. Mm-hmm. But it's giving a message. I understand that mm-hmm. there is a priority to the projects selected, mm-hmm. and whether that means projects that have been selected in the past, in the future, perhaps we can work on that as well. I'm not certain about that.
Okay.
To be retroactive to a process that already took place.
No, we're only going to go perspective with this. Retroactive would cause a lot of problems.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, that would be mm-hmm. that would be welcome, because then I mm-hmm. think that allows the process to acknowledge this as well, the TAB
right.
process and the criteria around that as well.
All right. Ms. Bursaw, here's what we're going to do. We're going to lay this bill over, and it is going to get included into the omnibus bill tomorrow. Between now and about 8:30 tomorrow morning, we're going to give you the opportunity to come up with maybe a little more language so that it's very clear to MnDOT as to what the direction is here. And I would ask that you make sure that Senator Latz is on board here. Like I said, I think that this is a good bill. It's not a bill that's in search of a problem. It wouldn't have been here if there hadn't have been a few bumps along the way. And so if you could come up with a couple sentences so that it's clear to your department as to what direction we're supposed to take here, and make sure that Senator Latz agrees that that is, meets the criteria of the bill that we have here.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We have also submitted to committee staff some proposed off-ramp language to consider as well. I hope that you find that helpful in determining what language to include in the omnibus policy bill. I also wonder if you would consider having this bill travel on two tracks, mm-hmm. Both independently and as part of the omnibus policy bill.
All right. Senator Latz, on that request. First, let's Senator Dibble moves on line point 2.8 before the comma, insert, and subject to available funding. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail. Okay, so Senator Latz, here's what's going to happen. We're going to go ahead and let this bill go. You need to work with Ms. Bursaw. We'll add this to our omnibus bill on the Senate floor. That'll give you a good week and a half before, you know, to work everything out and make sure Ms. Berzovsky is in the loop. And we'll put that in on the Senate floor. All right?
Thank you.
And in the meantime, we're going to send this bill off to finance.
Mr. Chairman, the language that we submitted as off-ramp language, could we incorporate that into the bill now before it moves on?
No, not right now.
Okay.
There's a couple things that need to change here, and I want to make sure that it's copacetic with Ms. Berzovsky. I've already had my hand caught in the cookie jar of trying to write amendments on the fly, and I'm not an attorney. And
well, if Ms. Berzovsky and I could be in communication before we get to finance, perhaps we can put something together that's satisfactory and add it there.
Yep, that sounds good. That sounds good. On that motion, Senator Dibble has moved that Senate File 2502 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, okay. All right, Senator Dahl, we have Senate File 2755, and we do have a delete all amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. This should take very little time. I'm presenting Senate File 2755, and I do believe you do have an amendment coming by.
Senator Dahl, let's do this. Senator Skoy moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion does prevail. Senator Dahl.
This is a pretty simple deal we have here. This is moving a deputy registrar's office, and we are moving. This is in downtown New Prague, and the county line of between Scott County and LeSueur County runs down Main Street. And the deputy registrar's office is moving with the bank that previously housed this office, and they're basically moving across the street. So because we are moving from one county to another, we need to make this change. And I have with me Jim Hurst, who's representing the New Prague Bank and is the expert on this issue, if you have any questions.
Yes. Let's do this. Is there anybody in opposition to this bill? This is like a marriage. Speak now or forever hold your peace. Senator Day. Senator Day moves that Senate File 2755 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. And Senator Dahl will also make this part of our omnibus bill. To the consent calendar was Senator Day's motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
That's a really wild one. Senator Carlson, let's move to your bill real quick here. We're going to take pardon? Yeah, I think his bill is fairly well, there might be a little bit of controversy in it, but I don't believe not too much. Senator Carlson, Senate File 3615.
Mr. Chair and Committee, Senate File 3615, suspension of driver's license for payment of taxes or fees with a dishonored check. People are writing bad checks, and the money is swept out of the accounts, and then there's no way to recover it. So what we're looking at is a method to recover it, and I have Mr. Jim Hurst here to describe the mechanism.
All right. Senator Carlson, there is a delete all amendment
I have two amendments. One is the A1 amendment, which is the delete all, and then I have a minor verbal amendment to that amendment. The minor, we can probably do the minor one to it first, and that's just a matter of adding plural on line 1.32, who as owners. So what we need is parentheses with an S between inside. So to make owner into owners.
Which line is that on?
1.32 on the amendment.
Mr. Zosky says that we don't need that change, Senator Carlson.
There are plural owners on automobiles.
Well, then it should be owner or...
And it was recommended by the owners. Department, I'm told.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Senator Carlson, so it would read who as owner or owners?
Owners of a vehicle, correct.
As?
Owners of a vehicle.
No. Mr. Chair, I think you're saying, inserting the word to, instead of doing it Senator Carlson's way, we're talking about saying owner or owners.
Right. Owner. So it's either or.
Yeah. Sure, could be.
Okay.
That'd be fine.
Yep. All right, on the A1 amendment as amended, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail. Mr. Hurst, can you give us your quick 30-second why this needs to be law?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I represent the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. Briefly, this helps to correct a loophole in existing law. Through the fine work of the Department and the Division of Vehicle Services, we have over the past few years been able to initiate a program with the Department, which is in statute, by which if a deputy registrar office receives a bad check, and after due diligence of trying to collect on that, we are allowed to contact the Department to suspend the registration of the vehicle in question. However, there is a loophole that presents itself that by suspending the registration, that allows us the ability to catch that bad check when the individual comes in to renew their tabs on an annual basis. However, sometimes the individual sells the vehicle, in which case we have no recourse, certainly not against the new owner of the vehicle who then comes in for tab renewals. What this would do is then, in those cases, suspend the driver's license of the owner of the vehicle whose vehicle was in this situation.
Is there anybody here that wants to speak in opposition to the bill? Any further discussion,
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen.
This seems like a pretty good remedy, but it seems like we're going to be involving police departments and enforcement, and you know, by the time it's all over and done with, it could be way more expensive than the check. I'm just wondering, you know, who's bearing is there reimbursements for some of these costs by the person that writes a bad check?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olsen, currently the onus is primarily on the Deputy Registrar Office to try and collect on this bad check. I don't see an impact on law enforcement per se, except in the case where the individual is pulled over for some other unrelated offense and they run a check on the driver's license and see that. Certainly the individual in this case would also be notified of this as part of the process that we enjoy with the department, for instance. And certainly also once we do finally collect on that amount, we do impose a $30 fee, which is state law for collecting bad checks.
And Mr. Hurst, that $30 is supposed to recoup the cost of going after the dishonored check.
That's correct.
And I bet that covers about 1/100th of the cost?
Unfortunately, in some cases, right. Yeah.
Right. Further discussion? Seeing none, Senator on the Carlson motion to, let's see, the motion needs to be, where are we at here? Senate file 3615 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Carlson, we will make this also part of the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Eric Rudine from the department is going to help us with Senate File 3402. Mr. Rudine, I take it that, and Senator Skolgan, I'm sorry, can't be here this evening, so Senator Dibble is actually presenting his bill. Mr. Rudine, I take it that this is all worked out. Is that because you don't bring junk here?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs, and as far as we know, there's no controversy associated with this bill, and nobody that's opposed to this legislation. It would transfer a small section of trunk highway right-of-way that was acquired for a project up near Fergus Falls into the state rail bank, which currently has the Central Lakes Trail running over it.
All right. Senator Skoy moves that Senate File 3402 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar on the Senate floor. This will also be part of the omnibus bill. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Mr. Rudine. Next up, we've got Senator Ortman is on her way. Senator Dibble, how long do you think your bill will take? Okay, Senator Dibble, you're up.
All right.
Staff tells me that Senator Ortman is going to be a little bit yet.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 3572. As you may recall, we've had this issue before the committee previously. This is another run at the bill that we presented last year that had to do with railroad walkways. And as you recall, last year, Mr. Chair, we had a expansive bill that was very specific and very lengthy, and it required railroads, the larger railroads in the state of Minnesota to build walkways everywhere. Understandably pretty unhappy with that approach because it was extremely, extremely expensive and fairly onerous. I think what we were trying to do was to address a legitimate issue of walkway safety for railroad workers, trying to replicate some efforts that had occurred in another state. Since then, we've had a lot of conversation. The proponent, Mr. Qualley from the United Transportation Union, has had lengthy ongoing conversations with the railroads as recently as this morning with my House counterpart. We facilitated a conversation. This represents a dramatically scaled back approach to what we had proposed previously, and I think it really does accomplish my goal, which is to support two parties who I think are worthy of supporting. I think it's very, very important that we support freight, the movement of freight rail through our state. I think it's economically and environmentally very, very advantageous. It's extremely worthwhile to support how we can at the same time we support those who are working on the freight rail lines, make sure that their circumstances are as safe as possible. Very quickly, if I can, Mr. Chair, if I could offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Dibble has moved the A1 amendment. Senator Dibble, can you tell us what the A1 amendment
yes.
does?
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment removes some of the specificity around some of the details on walkways on page 2, lines 9 through 14. having to do with, you know, some of the walkway standards around switches. Mm-hmm. And then the second part, both of these are a result of conversation this morning, takes the word repaired out of the walkway exemptions and only speaks to in those instances when we're doing replacement and resurfacing, substantial work that's being done. Repair was non-specific enough as to create a lot of ambiguity. So scales back the bill yet even more, Mr. Chair.
On the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Senator Deble.
Just quickly to the bill, Mr. Chair. What we hope to accomplish, we set some general requirements for standards of walkways by railroad tracks. That's in the first section. Make sure that rail carriers are providing those walkways in the places where it makes the most sense, where railroad employees are working regularly, at least 5 days a week. Section 3 speaks about walkways near the switches. Section 4, this creates an exemption from compliance with some of the walkway requirements during heavy maintenance, certain weather conditions. Section 5 allows for petition process for a waiver to the commissioner. Commissioner can determine if that's warranted. Section 6 provides for a process of addressing violations, make sure that there's some due process, some good faith effort to resolve a difference of opinion before we get into a lengthy kind of arbitrated hearing process. And Section 7 creates some grandfather considerations, as well as takes a small railroad operators out unless there's unless the commissioner finds a reasonable reason to include a particular walkway that one of the smaller railroads owns. And to that, Mr. Chair, we have a witness, Phil Qualley. I know the railroads are here. They're going to speak as well.
Mr. Qualley, can you tell us why you brought the baking pans full of rocks?
Mr. Committee Chair.
Looks like what I had for dinner last night.
Committee members, who better than I? Thank you very much for hearing this bill again this year. We brought them as an example as to the two types of ballast we generally walk on the railroad. This is mainline road ballast that is on much of the track. It's not uncommon to find this ballast piled as high as this table here, and our guys and women walk on it at a slope. This is the second type of ballast, which is what we're proposing that should be in yards, which generally is in yards by the AREMA, American Railway Association, Manufacturing Engineering Standards. That is in yards, but also we'd like to have this around key specific walkway areas around switches. And this is an example that I brought for the committee that we would try to show you what we're talking about.
Questions from the committee?
Senator
Day.
I guess the question is, you know, how much does this all cost to get the right rock all over whatever?
Well, Mr. Qualley?
Committee Chairman, Senator, we believe that this will actually save the railroads money because we believe that walking on this type of ballast around switches and key locations will cut down on slip, trip, and fall injuries. And we are in the ballast business. The railroads are made up of rock and tie and steel. And we don't really see a great deal of additional cost. Much of the yards today are being built with this stone, but we look for these to be dropped in key locations. And we think that the railroad workers are covered by the Federal Employee Liability Act. It is not a state workers' compensation system. The cases can be quite expensive to the railroad carriers. We think that providing a safer walkway will decrease costs.
Mr. Qualley, do you know what the difference is between the Class 5 and whatever class that is, the gray material?
I think this is 4-inch boulder wrap. Your question, I'm sorry, Mr.
But the cost difference, and you're not talking about doing the whole railway with Class 5, you're just talking about those areas of high foot traffic, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
This is far more expensive than that, Class 2.
Mm-hmm.
May I proceed with my comments,
Mr. Oh, yeah, please.
Thank you. I would like to thank the committee once again. I'd like to give just a quick brief update of what went on this last year since we were before you last, go through the bill's provisions, which actually the chief author has done quite well, and close any my comments and answer any questions you may have. I would like to point out respectfully, Mr. Chairman and committee members, you do have a handout that is an era study on the physical impacts, ergonomics of walking on large ballasts is from Boston University. I hope you can take a look at this briefly. We have also have a handout that has the Federal Railroad injury statistics, photographs of what we observed this last November, as well as safety committee process sheets that, quite frankly, just aren't showing any progress to clean up the right-of-ways. Very quickly, this bill that we brought forward is a derivative of last year's bill. We're very, very pleased, and we thank this committee that from last year's bill, our request for a state track inspector for strictly track and bridge is in the 2007 policy omnibus bill. We feel that's a big step forward to protecting our workers, but most importantly, protecting the public, and we thank you for that. Also, last year's bill, we asked for a definition of obstructions. We've retired that request, and it gets down to the walkway piece. Senator Dibble has given you a fine explanation of what this bill does. We think the key components is that it gives the carriers the opportunity to apply for a waiver for an exception to compliance. It gives the carriers assures that the complaints will go through a process where they know about them first and there's they have the opportunity to fix them through written procedure on their own properties. And finally, we really like that piece, that this assures that before any complaints are brought forward to the state, that the workers on the property as well as the carrier management have the opportunity to improve their conditions internally on that company. We think that's a very good feature. Finally, there is the grandfather provision that basically says the way everything is now is the way it stays until such a time you would go in and resurface the track or replace a track. And we
So Mr. Qualley, so then this is prospective. You're not asking them to rectify things from 2 weeks ago or 2 years ago. You're just saying that when this section is going to be upgraded, that these changes need to be made.
Mr. Committee Chair and Senators, yes, that is correct.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good.
We have also compromised off some of our key locations. It gives me a great deal of concern that we have given up some key specific locations, but we feel the honor of the House to find a compromise. That's what we need to do. That's what we should do. Finally, I just want to touch on the issue of federal preemption. I'd like to point out, and as well as, again, going back to the cost, last year after the legislative session, we sat back and watched the railroads to see if they would fix things up and, you know, how things would go, knowing that this legislation was alive. Unfortunately, we really didn't see any positive movement. So in November, the photographs started coming into our office, state committee office, and very quickly we filed three test complaints to MnDOT. And, you know, knowing that they didn't have the staff to process, you know, 20 or 22 of them, of the three complaints, the former commissioner was kind enough within her duties to apply to the Federal Railroad Administration, Joseph Boardman, in asking, essentially, were her duties not preempted by federal law? Was the issue federally preempted? And finally, were the did they not have the qualified personnel to take care of these three issues? We're very pleased to have received a March letter, March 3rd letter back from MnDOT that was a reply from the FRA legal department saying that the state is not preempted to have the commissioner of Minnesota exercise her powers to protect the safety of railroad workers on issues that are germane to, you know, Minnesota law. I just want to touch on that. It's a very important piece here. And finally, this bill makes sure that the absolute key provision of railroad safety is track drainage. We have no contest that track drainage is absolutely fundamental to railroad safety. And while this is mainline railroad ballast and allows for drainage, we are only really talking about this smaller ballast being spilled out around switch stands or perhaps where people commonly walk, respective of assuring the drainage standard in that area. I'd like to close by saying that, there are literally two points of view on this. The carriers will tell you something else. We respect their concerns for cost. Again, we believe this will save them money. But we're the people that are out, working on the trains, and we thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Senator Dibble, I do believe that someone is here, Mr. Solness from MnDOT.
Filling in.
Oh, okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Pull the microphone over.
There you go. Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I just ask a real quick question about Senator Murphy brought up the fact that this was prospective, that it would only And I find the language, I believe, that covers that, the new track yards in Section 2. But then down a little further under other tracks, it does allow for notice and hearing if someone could bring a notice and I guess I don't know the actual whatever term, bring a complaint, and then the railroad could be required to replace all of that that was constructed before July 1. So it's not 100% prospective. There could be...
I'm sorry. Where are you looking, Senator?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble. Section 2 is the prospective portion, that those portion of yard tracks. But then down here in Section 3, subdivision or paragraph C, yes, after notice and hearing, but they could be required to construct new walkways even on those areas that were built before July 1st. So I just – am I reading that correctly?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, you are, and we should have made note of that. I think that's in those instances when there's a particular hazard that the inspector, the commissioner's designee notices really needs to be addressed. So, but the spirit of the bill, or the larger intent of the bill, is in contrast to the earlier idea and proposal, which was let's go in and make sure all the track in the state, practically every mile, had walkways alongside it. And so this bill is dramatically different than that. And so that was the earlier point that we were trying to communicate.
Senator Fischbach.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, well, maybe you can give me some idea of what notice and hearing is. I guess, it may be something that's contained somewhere else in statute that's not referred to here, and by no means am I an expert on the railroads. But is there already a procedure for this notice and hearing? What are they looking for? Depending on the bar that's set for that notice and hearing, we could be opening this wide up.
Sure. I think Mr. Qualley may be able to help us too, but I think notice and hearing refers to, the standard kind of inspection process, and then given an opportunity for some hearing, some opportunity to, in case there's a dispute or a difference of opinion, the good faith opportunity to reconcile the difference of views that is in another part of the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Qualley?
Mr. Committee Chair, Senators, thank you. Yeah, there is an administrative process with the Office of Administrative Hearings. However, we see this, and I do want to respect and reply to your comment about being prospective. I guess for those of us that work on the railroads, we're blind that our systems are 100 years old, the tracks have been there forever. But what we see is moving forward, and that if there's an issue, first it goes to the, you know, the carrier, and the carrier note is noticed, and we work through the processes on that property to make sure it gets fixed. Unfortunately, what's been happening in the past is there's a process, but it's just not getting fixed. And this is going on for years. So what we see here is that if there is, the carrier simply is not reacting to fixing a hazard that all have identified and agreed to on the property, then an application can be made to MnDOT with proof of evidence of, you know, the two parties working together. And then the commissioner would become involved. There are two routes there. And one is that the commissioner, after inspecting it, will have the track inspector, can order, you know, send a notice of compliance to that carrier or shipper or facility, and they have a period of time to comply with it. Otherwise, there's rights of appeal, and that's through the MnDOT hearing process.
Mr. Chair, I guess just one more follow-up. And
thank you.
I'm assuming that all of that you talked about, the letters, that's all somewhere else in one of these statutes that it's referred to in here. So we're not, it's not a new process. How is that, is that being used at all now? I guess that process to correct anything that's going on?
MnDOT is here, and they can speak to that. And that actually is a very interesting question that has a very interesting answer, which I learned a lot about this morning. If you look at Section 6, that speaks to some of it.
Well, and there's a lot of references to other statutes.
Right,
that's
right.
Why I'm...
We'll let MnDOT speak to it, perhaps, if you'd like to.
Thank you.
Mr. Gardner?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Gardner, MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. If you remember a year ago when we were discussing this issue and the question of process came up, we indicated we didn't have a specific process, and I think we were probably rightly criticized for that. The statutes that were in question had never been invoked. We'd never received a complaint in almost 20 years. Since that time, we've devoted a lot of attention and energy to developing specific complaint handling processes, working with the Attorney General's office. There's one process that we have developed specifically for walkway complaints. There's another process for general railroad safety complaints that's actually specified in statute that we've operationalized. We have received three complaints from the UTU about rail safety, one walkway complaint, and two other general safety complaints. Those are being processed. Two of them are going to contested case hearings. Those hearings have been scheduled. The walkway complaint is being resolved. The complaint was actually about industry track, not rail-owned track, but track, a spur leading into an industry that was cluttered, had obstructions. They admitted that. They agreed to clean it up, and they're pursuing the cleaning up of that situation. So that process does appear to be working fairly smoothly as we've laid it out. And there's an expense to that, and there's a process to go through as well.
Yeah. Any other questions from the committee?
Senator Carlson.
Ready to move?
Senator Carlson.
I think the...
Mr. Chair,
do we have more testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The representatives from the railroads would like to talk. And you're going to testify?
Yeah.
Oh, and MnDOT's going to testify.
Instead of just
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kline. You want to come back? Mr. Appitz, are you going first or Mr.
Chairman, yeah. We just flipped a coin and I guess it's my turn this time. It's
good to see you again. John Appitz of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, representing a number of the short lines and regional railroads and some of the larger railroads here, too, in the state of Minnesota. And we've all been here before. This is a little bit like Yogi Berra and doing it all over again. But let me reiterate a couple of things that I think we said last year, but let me start out with a caveat. And the caveat is that we appreciate what Senator Dibble has been attempting to do. This is no small undertaking in trying to fix this bill and the amendment he's brought forward. This morning we spent an hour and a half wrestling with this, trying to understand each side back and forth, and really do appreciate his efforts on this. I think still remains, though, the seminal question, which is, what's the wrong that we're trying to fix here? What is the problem that we're trying to fix here with a new set of standards and some other and some other information? Let me just share this. If I get the page, I want to just give you a quick little look at the railroad industry in terms of injuries, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about injuries that apparently are occurring in the railroad industry. I'll give you that. I don't know that we went through all the testimony that we've had in past years, but the discussion centered on unsafe conditions that railroad workers find themselves placed in on apparently some regular basis, sufficient enough for you to have to bring forward some legislation and correct this. I can tell you the railroads here in Minnesota, and there's 21 of them, 21 railroads operating in Minnesota, oppose this legislation for all the good work of Senator Dibble, and really kind of feel not special for being singled out, but rather criticized for being singled out and being fixed legislatively. The question, again, is what's the problem that you're trying to fix? What's the problem with railroads today? We all understand one basic thing, and there's nobody that understands this better than us. Trains and people do not mix well. Trains and people do not mix well, especially people who are unsophisticated about trains. So we go to extreme efforts to make sure that the work environment in which Mr. Qualley and all of his compatriots work are as safe as they can possibly be. The alternative, Mr. Chairman and members, is can spell disaster. That's why we have to be safe in what we do. So what do railroads do to try to create a safe environment? Outside of the procedure that Senator Fischbach just asked about, which is provided by the Department of Transportation, and they did develop it over the year and commend them for doing that. There was a lot of other things they got criticized for, but they put together a heck of a procedure. On the yards where we work and in the railroads where we work, if there are defects or safety problems, what do we do? What do you got for options? Well, we got daily briefings, and we talk about conditions and talking about safety being a primary issue that has to be watched every day. If there's an unsafe condition, the first line of finding out about an unsafe condition are the workers who are out there. And what can they do? They can call the dispatcher and alert the dispatcher to an unsafe condition. There's a track defect book where this information can be put down, somebody's assigned to remedy it, and you go through a procedure of making sure it's taken care of. There's a safety hotline. You pick up the phone and you call in the particular problem, and there are safety committees that have been developed over years where management and labor work together to resolve these problems. And these safety committees work all over the country, and they work in this area as well. It works. We don't need a lot of additional legislation. We took some steps last year to put some things in place, and we hope you don't single out the railroad industry for a solution. Because if you take a quick look at those sheets that I just gave you, I think they suggest to you that it's a lot of other industries that have problems in this area, if you want to classify them problems. Put them on a grade, Mr. Chairman and members. The railroad industry is not the first group to go after. There's several others. But we deal with our issues, and we hope you just wouldn't single us out with this particular legislation. Mr. Sweeney can give you some much better details about the situation in terms of how many actual reports there are.
Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Sweeney, first, did you have one injury last year?
Your personally?
Company? No, your company.
Yes.
That was one too many.
Okay. Yes, Senator, we did.
Go ahead.
I agree.
That's my thoughts on safety.
And we agree.
Agreed, Mr. Chairman.
And okay. That is why, as Mr. Appitz has said, we have been working on the situation. And if you have some sheets here, I'd like to have passed out that, thank you, that show pretty pretty clearly, I think, that the industry has been working on this subject. As Mr. Appitz indicated, we are opposed to this legislation, and first and foremost because we have yet to see the major problem that needs to be addressed. In Minnesota in 2007, as you can see on the sheets that are being handed out, there were 22 total injuries sustained by railroad workers, 22 that were related to falls. Those are the injuries that show up on the Federal Railroad Administration statistics. That's about half the number of falls per year that there were 10 years ago. Of those 22 falls, 8 were listed as being the result of ballast conditions, an object on the ballast, or an uneven surface, such as a gully or whatnot, a steep grade, a total of 8 out of the 22. And that figure also is less than half of what it was 10 years ago. In the 5-year period from 1998 to 2002 in Minnesota, railroads averaged 21 such injuries each year. In the last 5 years, the average has dropped down to 9. And yet we're being asked to address a problem that is already, it would appear, being addressed. It has been cut by a half in just that period of time. So it would be one thing if railroad employee injuries were rising, but they're not. They've declined steadily since 1997, as you can see on the sheet. It would be one thing if the number of falls was rising, but that has also dropped dramatically. And then finally, what this legislation would address, those falls happening in these particular locations, those have also dropped dramatically in that period of time. So all the trends are going in the right
direction. Mr. Sweeney, can I ask a question here? Which direction has the complement of workforce been going, up or down?
In the past 10 years, there has been some fluctuation. It has been going up in the most recent years, though, Senator.
More employees, fewer injuries.
Right.
Okay.
A true measurement would be if we could somehow compare our injuries per man hours worked with the rest of the world. But because we're not under workers' comp, the Department of Labor and Industry statistics that I've got there, it's tough to really match up. Those numbers, the 4,310 falls, for example, in 2006, those are injuries that from falls where the person missed at least 3 days of work, triggering workers' comp. Mm-hmm. We don't, because we're not under workers' comp, we don't have a real apples-to-apples comparison. But I put our number of falls, FRE reportable falls, to give some sort of an indication of where trends are in our industry versus the rest of the world to see if there's been some change going the wrong way. So when, but to get a true year-to-year, yeah, we would have to somehow get down to the per 200,000 man-hours worked and do that straight line. But number of employees, roundabout way of getting back to your question, if anything, it's up in recent years. As freight traffic has grown steadily. The proposed solution, I would also get back to what was discussed earlier about the existing law. Yes, it does allow to address specific locations where there is a problem perceived. As was noted, this existing statute has not been used in collective memory, I guess, until this last year. And it appears that the three cases or the three complaints that were filed are not items that would be addressed by this legislation. One was a bridge, which is not part of this. One was a handrail, which is not under this, and the other was for a walkway, but it was on an industrial-owned walkway, which is exempted from jurisdiction by this bill. So of the three complaints that have been filed, none of them would be addressed by this. So we also have some concerns about drainage was mentioned. We do have some concerns. The large rock, yes, it does allow drainage. It's imperative that that we have good drainage. Water is the enemy of track. There are concerns about the smaller ballast in many locations. A question was raised about the cost. It's really impossible to say. Certainly last year's was a huge, huge expense. It would have been many millions of dollars had that legislation been enacted and enforced.
This one, it's hard to say exactly what it would cost because it has been scaled back. We would have to do an inventory of our various yards to see what tracks are currently up to snuff, so that if there is some significant work done on them, that would trigger us having to install these walkways or modify the existing walkways. So it's hard to say. If we do have to construct new walkways, the cost will vary on the according to the location. If we had to start from scratch with a lot of grading work and so on, it could be as high as $75,000 per mile. Other areas, it would be far less. So it's impossible to give any good number that you could take to the bank as to what this would cost. Over time, though, yes, it would cost some money.
Well, Mr. Sweeney, it seems like Senator Dibble has honed this down just to a couple sections of high-volume foot traffic areas around switches and in those areas where switching does take place.
Yes.
So we're not talking about the need to do from Red Wing to Winona.
Right. Chairman, that's correct. And, again, we do appreciate the effort that has been made as recently as today following our first discussions on this with Senator Dibble to tailor this back even more. It is a good step in the right direction. But, again, we come back to the question of how big a problem is there that is being addressed, and is this type of legislation necessary to address a problem that has been improving dramatically over the last 10 years.
Senator Scoy and then Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sweeney, I don't know if I would have used those three examples not being in the bill, because I think if we go back to the original bill, they probably were. I would bet that Senator Dibble in his compromising has removed those three examples from the bill. So I don't know if that was the best approach to convince me. Thank you.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be either to Mr. Apitz or Mr. Sweeney on the question of why. In my other world, I drive on our state highways and federal highways with a semi-truck behind me. And if there's something wrong on the road, they're fixing it. But I've got pictures here. And I remember pictures from last year that were really quite dramatic, I think, of railroad ties laying all over the yard and stuff like that. And this is more, you know, like silica sand, obviously a tanker's leaking or something, and there's sand piled up in the yard. So I guess that kind of goes to the why, is because there's evidence being presented to us that there's instances in the yards, because these look like they're switch yards, where there is a hazardous condition, and they may or may not be addressed promptly. We don't know that because this is just a picture from a certain time. Don't know what the follow-up is. But I remember those pictures last year were really quite dramatic as an unsafe yard. So that's probably the why. Because obviously there's a condition and it's still there, or it was there at the time of those pictures. So to me, that does show that there's not... You know, the public highway system, something happens and somebody's out there fixing it. I'm not seeing that with the information that we've been presented by Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there are 4,500 miles of rail track in the state of Minnesota over all kinds of terrain. Thousands of cars per day and locomotives traversing that track. I'm sure that at any given time, on any given day, yes, we can find a spot where there's something on the right-of-way, whether it came from a train or whether somebody decided to dump their trash on the right-of-way, whatever the source, I'm sure that there is. Now, is it being removed promptly? When we get reports, yes, we act on them. And again, we have a statute in place that if something is out there and is not being addressed, there is a process in place now where a complaint can be filed, and yet those complaints are not being made.
Mr. Chair. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, would the complaint, a follow-up if I may, would the complaints be made to the railroad, or what are the avenues that complaints are made? Are there more than one avenue for a complaint? Because I'm just trying to get a scope as to whether or not there might be complaints filed somewhere else that you guys aren't getting, or that that's interesting information that there's only that many complaints. So that's why I'm wondering if there might be another place that complaints are logged.
Chairman, Senator, the complaints could be filed with the company. They first, you know, probably would most likely would go to the company, the various systems that Mr.
Are you referencing injuries, Mr. Olson?
No, Mr. Chairman.
I just want to make sure we're answering the right question here.
They
could complain to us. They often do. They could complain to the Federal Railroad Administration, particularly if it is, you know, the track itself, which is under the Federal Railroad Administration jurisdiction, track instructor. This area between the tracks, the walkways, and so on, that they can file a complaint with the state of Minnesota, with the Minnesota DOT.
But can I just, Mr. Chairman, just add?
Mr. Happy.
That's sort of the outside pieces. Just listen to what I was talking about in terms of what goes on within the railroad itself. I mean, the first line of defense when you have an unsafe situation is to call the dispatcher, or is to report it to a superior. There's just practical ways of going about dealing with a whole lot of this stuff. Then subsequently beyond that, there's the track book. You log it in. You have somebody identified that has to go deal with the situation. There are safety committees, and you got to participate in the safety committees for the safety committees to work, but the safety committees seem to be working all over the country. They are management and union, and they figure out how to deal with some of these issues. You heard last year, and you'll be told they don't work as well as some people would wish them to work. They seem to work in a lot of different places. And finally, if all else fails, you call the Department of Transportation, which is a recourse which has been put to some advantage this particular year. I think we're testing it a little bit to see if it worked. And interestingly enough, MnDOT responded and put together a system that is working today. So mm-hmm. There's ways to deal with it.
All right. I think the horse is dead. It's been beaten 3 years in a row. Senator Dibble, this council tells me that this has at least one more stop that it needs to make, and that's business and industry and possibly judiciary as well. So Senator Dibble would move that Senate File 3572, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Business and Industry. Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, I think it behooves all of us on this. And Mr. Sweeney, one of the things I wanted to know was, I got a quick question, really quick. The falls or the mishaps or whatever, do you find them in like the Seven County metro area, or are they out in Worthington and La Crescent and whatever? Where do the most of these accidents happen that they do fall?
Chair, Senator,
if you know.
The ones for the rail industry, are you talking total or the slip, trip, and fall on the
slip,
track?
Slip, trip, and fall.
I don't have locations for those.
Okay.
Whether you know it's in a yard or out on the line someplace. If it's Minneapolis, St. Paul metro area or Wilmer, it's I don't have that breakdown.
Okay.
It is possible, I believe, to get a county breakdown from the Federal Railroad Administration.
Yeah. That's fine. That's, Mr. Chairman, I think it behooves all of us. We're in transportation. What we're trying to do is we're trying to get semis, you hear it all the time, off the road, more things on rail, because we don't want all that. So we want to help rail, and we want to get more things going. It doesn't seem, I mean, this is like we're trying to solve something that isn't even a problem as far as I can see. We got a lot of other things that are much more serious than this. And so we're going to send it out where they're all going to go out and they're going to start putting this other type gravel all around and everything. I grew up 3 blocks from the railroad in downtown Rochester. My guys used to run 40 miles an hour and jump on the back of trains, jump off trains, and that's when everything was moving around. And I mean, I think they probably still jump on and off trains when they're moving. I don't know. I mean, probably we'll get down somebody who will say, well, you got to stop the train, and then the guy can jump back on. I don't, maybe they do that already. But anyway, I just can't see that why do we want to send something down the line here that is going to cost railroads a lot more money when there really isn't any kind of a major problem at all? So I I'm opposed to it. So I
Understandable. On the Dibble motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ortman, her bill, Senate File 3439, is it was referred to taxes, but I believe that it needs to go back there because there is a there will be a fiscal note. But Senator Ortman had to leave for the day and asked that I present this bill.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 3439 is a bill that Senator Ortman put in. Basically, all it does is it allows members of the armed services who are serving someplace outside of the U.S. in a federal active military capacity to have exemption for paying the motor vehicle sales tax on one qualifying vehicle. I've talked with DVS. They believe that this has a nominal, a very nominal impact. What I would like to do, folks, is to move Senate File 3439 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Tax Committee, and also put it in tomorrow's omnibus bill. And by the time we get it to the floor, Ms. McCormick tells me she'll have an accurate fiscal note.
Any discussion? Any questions from the committee? Senator Murphy renews his motion. Senate File 3439 be recommended to pass and go to the
taxes.
To taxes for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Same sign.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and committee member, Senator Moi, we're going to go with your 2642, the Safe at Home bill first. And I believe Ms. Frazier is here as well.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much. I know that you've had a long night, and so let me move very quickly through the bill. And then to the extent that I have deficiencies, Ms. Frazier is here fully available and capable of answering questions.
Senator Moi, we have you have an amendment for the bill, a small technical amendment. Go ahead and pass them out.
Oh, all right.
Senator Moi moves the A3 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Moi.
All right. Mr. Chair, members, the Safe at Home is Minnesota's address confidentiality program for Minnesota residents who are victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, or otherwise fear for their safety. Safe at Home was authorized by the legislature in the 2006 session with the implementation date of September 1, 2007. This is modeled after similar programs in more than 20 other states. Participants in the Safe at Home program obtains a new legal address that they can use in virtually all government, business, and personal transactions. All participants' mail is received by Safe at Home and forwarded on to their actual address. Eligible voters who participate in the Safe at Home program may cast absentee ballots in their home precincts without disclosing their actual address or appearing in the public voting records. So, the gist of the bill is this. Section 1 of the bill defines the term mail, M-A-I-L, to clarify which items would be forwarded to the program participants. And it is defined to include letters and flats, large envelopes sent by first-class mail, items that clearly indicate that they are sent by government agencies, or clearly identifiable pharmaceuticals. It excludes packages, parcels, periodicals, and catalogs from a cost perspective. It just makes sense to exclude that. Section 2 of the bill changes the application for the Safe at Home program to require that participants give the Secretary of State consent to confirm participation in the program to those who provide a participant's name and lot number. And secondly, it changes the application to require that participants provide other information as required by the Secretary of State. Section 3 of the bill modifies the consent for release of information. Currently, the statute states that a consent for release of information from a participant, applicant, or eligible person is not valid. The amendment or the changes in the bill ask that this limitation be restricted to just consent for release of the actual address. And that is to make it comport to Section 2, where we're allowing them, asking them to be able to release information. Subdivision 2 of Section 3 deals with releasing data to the BCA. This was part of an amendment that was put on the Judiciary Committee at the request of law enforcement. It basically creates a process for Safe at Home staff to provide data about participants to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and for them to provide it to law enforcement when it is needed to respond to an emergency situation, criminal complaint, or investigation. Sections 4, 5, and 6 are the sections that I think are critical to this committee. It clarifies that participants in Safe at Home can obtain a driver's license or a state ID card by only providing their designated address to DVS. And the amendment that you just adopted changes clearly identified pharmaceutical to clearly identifiable and adds a section to Chapter 13 to state that the data released to the law enforcement in Section 3 subdivision above are private data. And that is the gist of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Moi. Senator Moi, we're going to make this real quick here. Is there anybody in opposition to this bill? I didn't think so. Great. Senator Moi moves that Senate File 2642 be recommended to pass and as amended. Senator Moi, does this need to go back to your committee or?
It does not. Mr. Chair, it goes to the floor.
Great. This will be sent to the floor and we'll also make this part of our omnibus bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senate File 2644 was presented the other day. It basically rolls back all the surcharges and fees, court surcharges, public defender co-payment of fees, as well as the DWI reinstatement surcharge. It rolls it all back to the pre-2003 era. And so if there are any discussions or questions, Mr. Chair, I would be willing to entertain that now. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Olsen,
I don't know where it is, but the highlight showed that the DWI fines have been dropped dramatically.
First page.
But I have an issue with that.
Here.
The Mr. Chair, the DWI. Fee of $250 remains in place. It is a surcharge that now has increased from $50 to $450. It reduces back to the $50 amount, creating the total payment for reinstatement of a driver's license, taking it back to $300 total.
Mr. Chair?
General Scene.
Maybe it's my Swedish heritage, but there's not a lot of tolerance in Sweden for repeat offending on drunken drivers, and I think we need to send a very strong message in this state that you know, we're hearing so many fatalities are caused by drunk drivers and alcohol related accidents, and the carnage that is caused by that. To me, this just seems like it needs to be. You know, I can understand the discussion had been about splitting the fine over 2 years, but I think dropping it that much, Senator Moi, just seems like it's it's not the right course to go.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, if you would suggest a proposal or if you would like me to not roll that back, then why don't you suggest that, and I will accept it as a friendly amendment. But I have to tell you that that is one of the issues that we have a lot of people driving without a driver's license. It is not being soft on crime. It is not being soft on people who have DWI convictions. These individuals are coming back to get their driver's licenses reinstated because they have paid their penalty, they have done their time to society as ordered by the courts, and by law, we're allowing them to come back and get their driver's license reinstated. And in order to do that, we're already asking them to pay a $250 penalty. This $50 surcharge, somebody dreamt up somewhere that we would stick a surcharge on them in addition to the penalty to for it to go somewhere. And so when 2003 came along, we said, well, why? You know, just tack on another bunch of money. So then that little surcharge of $50 went all the way up to $450. So, Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, if that is what's giving everybody heartburn and it's what's giving everybody heartache, I am more than willing to reconsider the rollback on the DWI surcharges in light of the fact that Senator Latz has passed the bill to give it installment payments. But please note that it is a public safety issue that's implicated here. The more onerous we make it for people to be able to reinstate their driver's licenses, more and more people, and this is what I've heard from DWI defendant lawyers as well as, you know, courts and people on the streets, is that we're making it difficult for people to reinstate their driver's licenses. People are driving without driver's licenses, and they're driving without insurance. And that is a public safety issue. So.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moi. You know, you make a strong argument for the DWI reinstatement surcharge being lowered. But I think we can make a stronger case to keep it on. That wasn't put on there just willy-nilly. It was put on there as punishment, period. You know, no amount of reinstatement fee is going to reinstate those families that lose loved ones to DWI offenders, which is roughly about 30% of all of our fatal accidents that happen on the roads. Now, if it was up to me, I feel like Senator Olsen. You know, he has Swedish heritage, and I have Irish heritage. And in Ireland, you get a DWI, and then you get to pedal your bike or walk, period. And one DWI. It doesn't take multiples. But it's there for punishment, period. Many of us are tired of especially repeat people. Now, I understand that there's a whole group of people that are underneath the radar that don't have driver's license, that don't pay this reinstatement fee, and we're never going to get them. But it wouldn't matter, in my opinion. This is just my opinion. I have no empirical evidence. But the vast majority of those people wouldn't pay it, whether it was $400, $4,000, $50, or $4. They just won't do it. They're going to drive you legally. I would hope that our committee can take at least that portion of the bill and take it out and then move this along.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Moore.
While I won't consider that necessarily a friendly amendment, I don't see it as a hostile amendment. So I would welcome your input on how to make that happen.
Okay, we'll have Ms. Berzovsky, our expert, take care of that. Senator Deville.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do wonder, you know, I understand, you know, people have different views of this $430 that was tacked on in 2003, and people feel strongly about it being there. But I do wonder, and it would be interesting to know, we have a lot of anecdote, it'd be interesting to know if we could really get to some actual numbers about how many folks are not reinstating because of that. You know, the situation will probably be improved with the installment plan that we passed, but you know, I hear that. I hear that, you know, it had a certain intent. I mean, part of it was budgetary, but part of it was punitive. But in some cases, it's kind of a self-defeating step that was taken, as some professionals tell us. So it'd be interesting to know the numbers. And, you know, maybe I'd be more sympathetic to keeping it on after we get all the Senator Day's trains built everywhere all over the place and people don't have to and buses and
all
stuff.
Right,
but people got to drive around this. This
Mr.
This
Chair, I was going to say send this thing to the floor. Let's get it down there. I don't mind debating $110 million to DWIs and people that have driven over people and killed them and everything else. It'd be good for the entire state to mm-hmm. hear this argument instead of just a few of us at 9 o'clock at night.
Exactly.
Well, Senator Day, I'm sure that it's going to come pretty soon and you'll have your chance to weigh in on the Senate floor. Until then, we have Senator Fischbach, Saltzman, and Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, I was just curious. I can't remember right now because it is getting late. How many DWIs does it take to revoke a license?
One. Yes, McCormick, is it just one? One gets you revoked.
Rises every one.
Mm-hmm. And this is just for revocation, is my the way I read it. All right, thank you.
Right. Okay, Senator Saltzman.
My voice is leaving me tonight. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. And Senator Watt, you know, you've done a lot of really good work in this bill. But I know that when I went home the other night, this was the first thing I heard about from my kids, that while maybe when this was done there was a different intent, it's always it's very difficult to undo something because it appears like you're sending a different message. And that's what's really difficult is that when we're going to be doing some really important things in our policy bill on safety and trying to send a message to our young drivers, I think it's important that we be consistent with the message that we send them. And maybe this isn't the year to have this discussion, but to look at some of the things we've talked about tonight about, you know, why people are, you know, not paying the fee, I think, with Senator Latz's bill. But I commend you for everything else you did in this bill. But this particular piece, to have this bill stalled because of that, wouldn't be fair to you as well.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, I've agreed. So the committee is going to take that out.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
I think Senator Scoy was next and Senator Gimsey. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Waugh, while your efforts here are well-intentioned, when I look at the impact of the general fund this year, I just can't support your effort. You know, we're in pretty close to the same kind of financial shape, in my opinion, as we were in 2003. The governor's proposing reductions in the increase to the nursing homes. I can't support this kind of impact on the general fund this year. They're just not going to vote for this.
Mm-hmm. Senator Gimsey.
Well, beyond the DWI driver's license, thank you, Mr. Chair, is the court fees that really concern me. You know, I've got courthouses out in rural Minnesota that are considering closing down for a day out of the week, laying off court administrators and cutting services because they can't support the courthouses and the staff and everything. You know, $14.8 million of additional cuts to them I think is unrealistic and detrimental to the entire process there, so I also can't support this at this point in time.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gimsey, I would be more than willing to work with you on a bill to funnel all these fee increases to the courts. In the same year that the courts were forced to raise these funds, the courts suffered a reduction in their budget cuts. None of this money has come back to support the courts. So if you'll worry about, you know, somehow rolling this back to pre-2003, in fact, if the courts would get the budget that they had pre that 2003 biennium, they would be in better shape than they are today. They did all that work, and none of that money came back to them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, the budget that we just passed last spring wasn't my budget. You know, my priorities certainly would have been different had I been the one designing that budget. And I believe that our court systems would have probably had more money in them. I would have probably, my priorities certainly would have been different. So I wasn't here in 2003, but I am here now, and I just can't see this.
Well, Senator Gimsey, 2003 wasn't much fun, and 94 was even less, and this is turning out to be a 94, not an 03. So, Senator Carlson?
Mr. Chair, in hopes to move this along, I move to pull Section 1, to amend to pull Section 1 from the bill.
All right. And Ms. Spierzowski tells me that that is the DWI reinstatement. Is there any further discussion that's needed? All in favor of the Carlson amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Olsen.
Is there, you know, is there a fiscal note on this yet? Because Senator Scoy brings up a good point. I personally don't know what the budget impact is. I had heard the number for the DWIs.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there's a tentative number of about $120 million in the budget, a whole.
Right.
So, Mr. Chair, I know that this is a good committee, people who have integrity and they work hard. I know that there are people on this committee who feels as passionately and as strongly as I am about these onerous fee increases and surcharges. And in fact, for those of us who are concerned about public safety, the fact that we've imposed all these fees and surcharges and none of it has come back to help law enforcement, public safety, or the judiciary is something that concerns all of us. But I also understand the financial situation that we're in. I understand Senator Scoy's hesitancy. But I do want the Finance Committee to understand that what they consider to be a $120 million hole in their budget today is $120 million of funds that were raised on the backs of people for whom we've made justice not affordable to them and therefore not accessible. So if this committee would be willing to indulge me, Mr. Chair, as a member of this committee and as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I feel very strongly I would like to send this to the Finance Committee for them to have a chance to hear the message that I like to send to them. And so I like to ask that we refer this Senate bill to the Finance Committee without recommendation.
All right. Senator Moy, I believe that that would be an appropriate motion. And the reason I say that, Senator Moy, is that, and you've heard the discussion around the table, I don't think that there's a whole lot of wiggle room in our budget today, even though we've taken care of the one of the portions that relates to the policy portion of this committee. It does have to go to the Finance Committee where they'll look at the big picture dollar item. But you make a lot of good arguments, Senator Moy. We have made a lot of we've placed, as you say, justice out of reach for some people fiscally. You know, as a recovering alcoholic, though, I can tell you that nobody ever forced a jug of booze down my throat. And for those people who do get DWIs and drive impaired, that was the choice they made. And I would think that our committee would be remiss as to not try to attack that issue as aggressively as possible. So is there any further discussion on the WA motion? Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator WA, if this moves without recommendation, if it does get to the floor, which I don't think it's going to escape the Finance Committee's sharp pencil, I will not be supporting this on the floor.
Mm-hmm. Well, Senator Scoy, maybe I won't support it either, but I think it's important to get it to the Finance Committee to realize.
Mm-hmm. Senator Moy, we all understand. We understand your argument very well, and for 99% of it, I agree that we need to probably peel back some of these fees, and sometimes for fairly minor offenses. But then there's a couple others that you know, like Senator Scoy said, that they're going to give you some heartburn. Senator Day.
No, I was.
Okay.
We don't all. You said that something like we all feel that. I can't remember exactly what you said, but that you were in agreement with the good senator, and I just wanted to, I'm not in agreement at all with this, period. But I, if the committee wants to send a bill that nobody wants, everybody sits here and we say it's a terrible bill, but we're going to send it on down the line, we must have a lot of extra time. I don't know why we're all around here at 9, 10 o'clock at night. Another committee is going to go through all of the same stuff all over again? I mean,
Senator Day, I didn't say that this committee was in agreement with the bill. I think we're in agreement with the approach that Senator Moi is taking in looking at some of these administrative fines that people don't know that they have to pay until they show up at court and find out that all of a sudden they have another $430 that they have to come up with. It is a serious problem for a lot of low-income folks. But, once again, when it comes to the DWI, people make that choice to get behind the wheel. With that, on the WA motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator WA. Members, we're back at it at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning in room 15.
Oh, boy.
This in the morning?
Yes. And the committee is now adjourned.
That's helpful.